from where you are.
Sorry, I missed that one from?
Aluminium Federation.
Oh.
And Tom Morden from Sapir.
I'm Lorraine Lottis, I'm the convener of the Carbon Tax Task Team of Business Unity of Africa.
Mapelum Budula Esco.
Norman Ferrer, that's it. Steve Lennon, Esco.
Some or keenness to present their concerns or proposals that could be done today. Of course, let us agree, this is on the basis that this is a long chain, if I can put it mildly. It has an impact on a number of things. But safe to say, at this stage, it focuses on all the selfish benefits in any case, on energy. And let's see what are the agreements. And once we get all these inputs and exchange, please don't expect us to respond to the Committee on Energy on how things could be taken forward. But I'm glad that the chair for the Senate Committee on Finance is around, because trigger point is carbon debt, and also the Department for National Treasury is around. Because we will then go back and interact at a broader platform, having enriched ourselves within the space of energy. What are the concerns, what are the reasons for this, what are the likely impacts, and all of that. I think I've done enough preaching for now. If you look at the agenda, I'll combine the first two areas. And I would like us to go to the third point, which is sharing views on carbon price as a concept and a tool. I'm sure we wouldn't mind to have National Treasury helping us to pave the way for all the aspects of that second speech, the biggest thing. So we just wanted to ensure that we enrich ourselves in that context. But taking into account as well that there's still room for making people, on the overall program as driven by National Treasury. I see there are already two eager hands. More? Okay, let's start to see. Your name? If you could just, for the benefit of the others, introduce yourself to spell and where you come from.
Thank you, Chair. Jane Maloney from the Copper Paper Manufacturers Association. You talk about energy being the big issue. For us, energy is exceptionally important. The paper industry does acknowledge the need to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And at this current time, we are the largest producer and user of renewable energy. And in fact, every single year, we avoid the use of 1.3 million tons of fossil fuel and the consequential emissions as a result of the renewable energy that we need. Despite this, and despite the fact that the gentleman over there said we're starting, as Mr. Morgan said, we're starting at a very low level of carbon tax, and taking all of those things into consideration, the cost for our sector annually will be in excess of 250 million rand a year. And our biggest concern is that we don't actually believe that carbon tax is the right mechanism or tool to bring about that change to a lower carbon economy because of its potential for negative impact on an already seriously stressed manufacturing sector. It's common knowledge that one of our companies, one of our members of Panther, do not make any money. And you just have to look at what's happened to their share price. The paper industry actually contributed in 2011 2 billion rand to the balance of trade, and that has dropped, well, it was 2.7 billion, it's dropped to 1.6 billion. So it's dropped by more than a billion rand in a year because of the increase of imports. 50%, an excess of 50% increase of imports since 2008, Chair. And our sector is responsible for almost 4% of manufacturing GDP, 27% of agricultural GDP, and 0.6% of national GDP. So if you look at the impact on our sector alone, it is going to be huge. And the knock-on effect, because over 70% of the 1.2 million hectares of trees are actually consumed by pulp and paper manufacturers. So if we are not prosperous, it goes all the way back into the rural areas. We have chatted to National Treasury, and they have said that there are opportunities for looking at carbon sequestration in trees. If this happens, and it's acknowledged, there is potential for development in the Eastern Cape and in KwaZulu-Natal for communities. But this is only if it's taken into consideration. The one other thing in the paper, it actually only mentions forestry once, and it talks about the potential for offset mechanisms, but that's only 10%. If you look at our process, we can't do without trees. So there is an internationally acknowledged tool called the Forest Industry Carbon Assessment Tool, or FICAT. And that would actually allow you to measure exactly how much carbon is sequestered and what the emissions are through the whole process. So from our perspective, we would submit that you talked about CCS, and for us, trees are the best carbon storage mechanism around. But unfortunately, we can't plant that many trees. There's only capacity for a further 100,000 hectares. And that's according to the Forest Sector Charter Council, and that's a mandatory commitment to 100,000 hectares, and it means 20,000 hectares being planted every year. But that is the maximum that we can go when it comes to mitigation. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair. The members of the Portfolio Committee.
Actually, if I may, take up a point that you said right at the beginning, Chair, and that is that the energy sector is the biggest pillar in this regard. And we are all, as consumers, as citizens of this country, users in one way or another of the energy sector. So a lot of the products that we produce, etc., we can only really address climate change if it's done in a holistic way. From our side, I'd maybe like to pick up our points in the main under the heading of timing, rather than going into all the detail, which we will do by submitting a response to Treasury's paper. The timing under three headings, and that is really keeping an eye on the international developments, pricing signals, and also the Department of Environment policy implementation. Now, if we can maybe start with the last one first. We in South Africa see that the Department of Environment is really the lead department as far as climate change goes, and that policy needs to be aligned with the policy that department is pursuing, which is around the carbon budget and the work that's done through the technical working group at the moment. And introducing a carbon tax prior to that work having been completed, we see as running the risk of being premature and not necessarily being aligned with what will come from that work. So that is a major concern for us. On the second point, from a pricing signal point of view, and that aligns also with comments made by Eskom just gone before here, is in a broader context as well from the industry point of view, is what alternatives do we have? And taxing the industry, which ultimately doesn't have alternatives, certainly in the shorter term, to switch to lower carbon sources, is not going to assist in terms of reducing the emissions. So in South Africa, as we all know, we heavily reliant on coal, both in the electricity but otherwise energy sector as well. And within the jurisdiction of South Africa, there are really limited alternatives as a feedstock. And, Chair, as you mentioned earlier on, and as the heading of this round table also indicates, you should take note of what is in the southern African area or region available, where there are many other alternatives. And so, certainly, if we wanted to address materially reducing carbon emissions, is to actually take into account what is available. As most of you probably know, we've got the gas facility in Mozambique, which has really made a significant impact on our carbon emissions, dropping by more than 6 million tons a year by introducing natural gas at our Sasolburg facility in 2004. And similar to what we see in the United States, without any real policy at federal level, at least, or at national level, what can impact the introduction of gas to carbon emissions, where there's now a substantial decrease in greenhouse gas emissions in the United States due to the exploration of shale gas, much more so, we would argue, than you could achieve by any policy instruments. So that's an aspect to consider also in timing of introducing something like the carbon taxes, and what alternatives do industry have, and be afforded an opportunity to actually develop these alternatives to bring them to effect. On the international side, EDG's comment earlier on that, you know, to some extent we must forge ahead regardless of where the international policy situation is, how I understood it. A lot of our exports are energy intensive exports, as I'm sure other members on this table will highlight later on. And that's really where our international competitiveness in these industries really comes from, is these energy or electricity price plays a major part in that. And we need to make sure that we don't lose out or are not
engage on this matter, get the project that we know how to reach from an energy perspective, because that's what we are assigned to do as in Parliament. Dr. Lotta, I saw there was a hand for solar side. Oh, they all IEG. Okay, over to you.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the opportunity. Good afternoon, honourable members. I'd like to consider the question that you raised of carbon price as a concept and a tool. For us, one of the most important questions to answer is how is that tool located, both internationally and domestically. So we would agree with previous speakers that we have to look at the international arena, where South Africa is a leading negotiator in developing new market instruments. The South African delegation in those negotiations is following it carefully, is making a major contribution to the outcome, which, as has been said, may be in 2015, but the implementation is not likely to happen before 2020, mm-hmm. when people have ratified whatever agreement is made. So we think it's important to locate it within that context. What is going on there? How could our domestic instruments ensure alignment with an international instrument? Treasury is correct that for us, as the type of economy that we have, it's a challenge to introduce a domestic trading scheme. But the international arena and the negotiations currently underway give us an opportunity to consider how we could trade internationally. So we need to be cautious in moving forward very rapidly in one direction when there's an international situation evolving around us. Then there's the question of locating the price in the domestic context and the domestic regulatory and policy context. Treasury is correct, and we're happy to hear that the paper is in fact taken from the white paper on the National Response Strategy on Climate Change. However, we need to be quite clear what that paper is saying. That paper is clearly saying that in order for us to address the challenges of climate change, and particularly mitigation, there is not a one-size-fits-all instrument. We have to take into account the possible range of instruments that we can use. We're working, colleagues have referred to the Technical Working Group on Mitigation, we're working with the Department of Environmental Affairs and other government departments on a comprehensive analysis of mitigation potential in the whole economy, not only in the energy sector. That work is not yet completed. It's imperative to complete that kind of work so that you have a good quantitative idea of what is possible before you impose an instrument which may not make a difference. As we've heard from Eskom, they can't change their behavior. Their behavior is regulated through the integrated resource plan. Other subsectors of energy are likely to be regulated. We don't know because the integrated energy plan is currently being developed. But we expect that in the integrated energy plan, there will also be a focus on lowering the carbon intensity of the economy. And from a business perspective, we agree totally that that is something that we have to do. We're not in any way disputing the need to act. But not introducing a carbon tax is not to do nothing. If we look at what has happened in Treasury, is correct that the steep increases in electricity prices have already significantly reduced the electricity intensity as a result of people being forced by price to behave in a different way and to change behavior. The question now arises, to what extent would a carbon tax actually result in us behaving even more differently? We're not so sure that it would have that effect, because we also need to, in terms of the domestic regulatory environment, understand the extensive competition within firms for scarce capital to address a range of more stringent environmental requirements. So that every new environmental requirement that we have to meet requires significant investment. If we're taxed, the amount of money available for that investment is reduced, and we think that needs to be very carefully considered. We're very pleased that we have the opportunity to engage on this paper, but we think that it's important to understand it within those contexts. It's important to understand the socioeconomic impact. And when we speak about carbon offsets and recycling, we think they are measures that could alleviate the impact of the tax. But the paper doesn't really say that they will be implemented. So we'd be very pleased to give you more detail also on those aspects which we think need significantly more work. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, does that go down the line?
That's
yes.
It? I don't think my microphone.
Yes.
There we go. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to talk on behalf of the crude refining sector, clearly an important role player in supply of energy, and clearly energy, any concerns about security of supply of that liquid fuel sector is of major concern. I'd start off by saying that as a sector... seem to have a loose connection.
You must say your name.
Sorry, my name is Anton Molden, and I'm from the South African Petroleum Industry Association. As I say, representing the crude refinery sector, which comprises of four crude refiners, one Cape Town, two Durban, and one in Sasolburg. To start off, I would like to address the theme of this roundtable, which is the likely impact of carbon tax on the energy supply. Well, that would be on the liquid fuels sector. To start off with, we certainly recognize the need for a move to a lower carbon economy, and we are committed to work with government to find the most achievable and practical outcome of that. As far as our sector is concerned, and surprisingly enough, the crude refiners are a relatively small contributor to the national greenhouse gas emissions and represent about 0.5% of the total national greenhouse gas emissions. And just to put that into perspective, the sector, which we feel is not a significant contributor, but does contribute some 6.48% to GDP and does employ some 100,000 people directly and indirectly. So we play an important role in the economy, but at the same time do not necessarily contribute significantly to the carbon emissions. And having said that, where do our emissions come from? Basically, they come from the use of fuel in our refineries, whether it be fuel oil, fuel gas, coke in the processes within the refineries. And fairly recently, we've moved from the heavier types of fuels, the fuel oils, to the fuel gases, which in itself has been really driven by achieving reductions in other emissions like sulfur dioxide, but has had the impact of decreasing the carbon footprint of those processes. And at this stage, an estimate has been done that having looked at the, and having been driven by other regulatory forces to look at energy efficiency in the refining sector, what can we achieve further? And it would appear that about 10% we could reduce it further, our emissions, by whatever means. But that really is the maximum. And if one looks at the enormous costs that would be entailed in achieving that 10%, further 10% reduction, one questions the cost effectiveness of it. It also raises the question of the economic viability of the refining sector, in that there are increasing and very large regulatory costs that are coming our way. For example, Clean Fuels 2, which is billed for July 2017, outdated figures put a cost of 40 billion rand on that. There's the biofuels, introduction of biofuels, mandatory introduction, which will also put a cost on the sector. There's the recent amendments to the minimum emission standards, which will result in the emissions, where it will result, it calls for new refinery emissions to be in place in this country in 10 years' time. So that means our old refineries will have to perform in the same way from an emissions perspective as a brand new refinery, a greenfield refinery within 10 years. And clearly that's going to be a significant challenge from a financial point of view. And then the carbon tax on top of that. One needs to emphasize the point that our product that is produced is a regulated product. The price is regulated, so there's no ways that there is any direct return on investment on these sort of regulatory requirements. And one needs to really point out that very few businesses will invest so heavily, and the shareholders of those businesses accept that they need to invest so heavily when there isn't that return on investment. So all these pressures are really having an impact on the decision-making process of whether it is prudent to carry on operating these refineries in this country. And the only other alternative to not refining, obviously, is importation, which has impact on jobs and balance of payments, etc. Just one last point I'd like to make is that the carbon contained in crude, 90% of it is passed through to the final product. And the final product is what the end consumer, the motorist, actually uses. And there might be some consideration, and the only way of addressing that is really to reduce the use of that product at the end of the day, to reduce fuel consumption in the marketplace. And that can only be done by the motorists themselves. So what is produced in the refinery, most of the carbon is passed through to the motorists where it is used by the motorists at the end of the day. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We also fully support that there needs to be a transparent and a predictable carbon price
fact, we've got a structure the design of the tax in that context. The current design is not structured in the context. The first question is, what informs us to increase the level of taxation from the level suggested in 2050 by 10% per annum? Why not 5% per annum? Why 5 years? Why not 10 years? There's no rational reason for that. We're saying that carbon tax, the change to an introduction of a carbon tax level, needs to be informed by international carbon price, not a timing related issue. The second point is that the tax design calls for the phasing out of the tax-free allowances after 5 years to extinction in 10 years' time. Why? Surely there's no sense in exposing your export industries and energy-intensive sectors if the globe's not going to do the same thing. Again, here we suggest that the design should then end carbon emissions to introduce a carbon tax through pricing, set it in the context of the global regime, not some arbitrary timing or percentage-related increases which have no rational justification. Chair, then I have to also just point out here that currently the Department of Energy, as you well know, is preparing an update on the RP and the IEP. That will take us beyond 2030. Let us remind ourselves, the RP 2010 only took us to 2030, in which all the current coal-burning power stations are still in place. What happens if government decides to introduce nuclear power stations beyond 2030 to phase out totally coal? The question is, why then do we need a tax? Because there the policy is that the government has decided they want to produce other forms of generation at the expense of coal and to introduce a very much more expensive price of electricity. I question the need for a carbon price in that context. So, Chair, in conclusion, I would just like to say that we believe that we are really doing a lot, much more, let me tell you, than other countries in the world, to the extent that we are being recognized as leaders in the introduction of renewable energy globally. So let us never again say we're not doing anything. We are leading in many respects. But we cannot lead. We certainly cannot lead on carbon price because the globe is expressing a lack of an appetite for it at this stage. And we're exposing our economy, our jobs and our country to rationally proceed at any cost on this basis. Thank you.
A little bit of change of course has been handled. I understand it is relentless, but not the meeting scenario. I was answering the really roundtable engagement and people exchanging views and presenting concerns. I think up to now we're getting quite a number of very, very interesting things coming from various symbols, informed by obviously each person's experiences and work in this arena. Can we just make a shift now? The faith communities, they can enter the discussion. Please introduce yourself.
Good afternoon, Chair. Liz McDay from the Southern African Faith Communities Environment Institute. And I'm feeling a bit outnumbered, I think, as civil society. I don't know who else is.
Never mind, you're protected.
So just to share some comments, is I think for us, part of the issue is to look at a society, and although yes, our economy has been based on fossil fuels to date, it has had costs and benefits, and the people who bore the cost and continue to bear the cost are not the same people that necessarily have benefited. And the costs of not pricing carbon are what we are living with at the moment in terms of health, acid mine drainage, the South Durban residents with their health costs. So I think the principle of ensuring that the externalities of our fuels are priced is a good one, and we support that principle. We also believe that just because the rest of the world is lagging in terms of addressing climate change isn't an excuse for South Africa to not do anything. So I think that's also positive. But not, I'm not going to really deal with some of that. I want to focus in on the paper, which has not really addressed the issue of how you mitigate the impacts on the poor. Because, as other people have sort of eloquently expressed it around the table, simply pricing carbon in terms of the electricity sector, and in fact the petrol sector as well, diesel sector, simply imposes a further price increase, because it will simply be passed on to the consumers. And that means that people who are dependent on a small amount of electricity, for example, per month, that amount of electricity will not stretch as far. We also, and I think, Chairperson, this is something that maybe the committee needs to pick up out of today, is the free basic electricity, how far is it reaching? Where is it not reaching? So the idea of increasing the free basic electricity will still leave a large number of households who have no access to electricity. They will not benefit, but they will bear the cost of the pass-through. And it will not only be the electricity, but it will be the general costs of goods and services that go up because of the increase in transport costs or production costs that the industry will no doubt tell us that will happen. So we believe that the timing of introducing a carbon tax is problematic. And the one thing that needs to be clarified is how are we going to mitigate to ensure that, yes, we've priced carbon correctly, but we have not further increased the burden on the poor and actually made our society even more unequal. So our focus would be on we've got some thoughts, but we'll put it into Treasury and discuss earlier, but how do we ensure that households do not bear the brunt of the carbon pricing? Thank you.
See, we were well protected. There was a hand which this side. Eskom, you came out in full force. I really know that they are each in a black, let's say, a spread of input. Honorable Fleming, for now. I'm not at this point.
model to be able to access those funds. And so my issue to you then as Treasury is to say, yes, I understand what you're doing and coming out with the carbon tax, but what are you doing on the other side in terms of ensuring that we can access those international funds? Are you setting up a funding mechanism so that we can at least get some kind of quid pro quo from the international community? If we're being progressive in terms of going after our own industry, at the same time we should be trying to access funds to try and mitigate those costs. And I'd be interested to hear from Treasury what you've done in that regard to see how we can be more progressive there. Thank you.
Back to that call. People along the wall don't think simply because they're in front of microphones with a bad vanish and then you. I really would like to encourage, you know, as much input as possible. Question the times, why not? Let's look at questions because we've got requisite expertise and experience, you know, in this room. I may make a valuable input based on the answer which I got from the question. So I really encourage that as well. Okay, ESCOM.
Thank you very much, Chair Steve Lennon from ESCOM. I want to just build on a point that was just being made about South Africa's role internationally. You know, the Department of Energy in putting together the Integrated Resource Plan has basically come up with a plan that results in a 34% reduction in CO2 emissions from the power sector by 2050, as has already been said. And that includes then an effective price for CO2 of 116 rand a ton. Now, as things stand at the moment, that we are already embarking on that route. 3% of the recent 8% increase in the price of electricity goes to pay for the renewables projects that are being implemented as we speak. Maduki and Kasile power stations are supercritical plants, which already means that they will be producing less CO2 per kilowatt hour than any of the other power stations in South Africa. So the point then, that when we looked at the proposals around carbon tax, is that it's very clear that there's a policy disconnect then across government. And I think that the point that must be made here is that we need to have better alignment. So for example, if National Treasury believes that the Integrated Resource Plan doesn't do enough to reduce CO2 emissions in the power sector, then I'd suggest in a revision of that plan that is being done as we speak, that they suggest that a different number be put in for the share price of CO2 in that plan, bigger than 116 rand a ton of CO2, for example. And I think that is a difference, whereby you can achieve exactly the same thing, but it doesn't help, as has already been stated, to add a further cost of CO2 on top of that plan. I think it's also just worth noting that plan also includes a 60% reduction in water utilization over that period, which is a very important one. So Chair, the first point I want to make is that between Department of Energy, Department of Environment, and National Treasury, is that I think we could do with some better policy alignment when it comes to mechanisms for the reduction of CO2 emissions. Just another point that, and I think that also applies to Liz's point about the internalization of external costs, is that the external costs borne by society of water use by the power sector, of CO2 emissions, of a whole bunch of other things by the power sector, are increasingly being internalized in those integrated resource plans. They do have cost implications, and those have to be addressed through things like free basic electricity. But another point, Chair, that we must never forget is that whatever we do to reduce our emissions, and our leading role has already been emphasized, whatever we do to reduce our emissions, we are still going to live with the negative impact of climate change. We are going to have to factor those costs into how we build our economy, how we build and design our infrastructure into the future. And that, I think, is something that all of us need to be very conscious of. The final proposal, Chair, is that the Integrated Resource Plan has got a premium cost of some 78 billion rand. That's effectively the 116 rand a ton of CO2. And if we consider the President's
quite important that people express their views, but people are coming like, this is the ESCOM view. I don't believe that's the ESCOM view. Because if it is the ESCOM view, how does ESCOM arrive at that view? I'm saying this because, not because I'm a target on ESCOM, and I think debate is very important, but I think that it's quite important that we do take a long-term perspective. And if we don't act now, the cost could be higher. There could be more people losing their jobs, because in 10 years' time, the emissions reach such a level, if you look at the Stern report, that it's going to be even more costly to act. The poor will be even more affected. Then, so now, I'm not saying that's a certain outcome. I'm just saying that there's two sides to this. And I think what the debate here is reflecting is, and I think the lady from, sorry, I forgot your name, said she feels lonely. I don't mind feeling lonely, but I think that, when I look at this discussion, I say, was the Department of Environmental Affairs invited? Because I think putting their perspective is important. Seriously, they were invited and they're not here, because they certainly need to put the policy position that government has put forward. Because I think that in some of the responses, I don't believe people's views are, I think that the views of on the white paper are being misrepresented. People will say the same thing to us, so I'm not saying who's right, who's wrong. I'm just saying that it's quite important that we get those different perspectives. And in that sense, yeah, I think I welcome this discussion, because you rather have this discussion coming out than it's just a kind of lobbying mentality, no to the text. What is the alternative, I think, the question. The text by itself, yes, is not the important issue. It's the outcome we want of reducing emissions, not just in South Africa, but globally. And yes, if South Africa was the only one to act, it would not have much of an impact. You need to get the world to act. So shouldn't the question be, what can we do to get globally coordinated action? You know that in the US Congress, President Obama can't even raise the issue. He's raised it in a speech recently. But Congress will not support this. In Australia, the opposition has taken a similar approach to the Tea Party. Does this mean that we are right? Does this mean that we do nothing? I think those are important issues to address. So I think I think in looking at this and trying to take this discussion somewhere, I think is there are a lot of challenges. But let's look at the text. The intention is, and it's still subject to a discussion paper, so we welcome the comments. It's come in very, very low. Okay. And then to step it up. Yes, we've said that the text by itself won't achieve the outcome. Because you do need a set of complementary measures, including the global equality approach. Okay. But again, let me turn it the other way. Before we look at how you all the other measures that are being considered, it's therefore important that the UT is here. It's important that the people who deal with basic electricity are here. It's important that the other players in government, and you know, the electricity levy is not the only, it is a form of carbon tax, no doubt. We must have to put it up because we've got to pay for the plants currently. And I think that, you know, issues like Saudi Arabia funded, I don't deal with the expenditure side, but in the treasury, everybody, you know, in government, we all blame each other. Okay? Now, unless you get all the sides here, then and only then will you know, is money the problem? You know, there's a plastic bag levy. Institution was supposed to deal with recycling, has
think the overall context as we understand it is that, he said that our greenhouse gas emissions must peak, plateau, and decline, and he said this both internationally and in our national policy. And so I think it is important that the first part of that is really the first challenge is to slow the growth of our emissions, and that's really what we're looking at. And as many have said, and I would agree, that there is no single instrument that can do it all, or no single sector that can do it all. We could also, as you have, regulatory instruments. But pricing of carbon is an important part of the solution, I would agree. I mean, we could discuss the other elements, but really the proposal on the table, as I understand it, is particularly the carbon tax and the tax policy paper from Treasury. And all of our analysis points to this being a very important element, and we think that our focus of our analysis and comments, which we will submit as well to Treasury, would be on the best possible design. So we have some other considerations that go a little bit more into the detail of the design, but also relate to the bigger issues that people have been raising. Firstly, it does strike us that in fact the approach has been to introduce the tax at what we would consider a very low level. The effective tax rate is really between 12 and 48 rand per ton of CO2. The nominal rate, of course, is 120 rand. And those kinds of rates, from all the modelling that we have done, is not enough to transform our energy economy. And given that it is relatively low, at least we feel the design should be simpler and closer to what would be an ideal design. And we do think, with all due respect to all the work done, that the design is perhaps overly complex. Sometimes complexity is a good thing and it's necessary to address a whole lot of things, but having a nominal tax rate with an immediate basic threshold, I mean the 60% is what immediately takes it from 120 rand to an effective tax rate of 48 rand. And then process and trade exemption, debt factors, offsets. It's difficult to understand, and we're not always, well, we're certainly analysing that as carefully as we can. It's not always clear to us that the complexity there actually gives us more benefit. Particularly in relation to the thresholds that are set out, there are a couple of things. Given this relatively low level of attacks, we don't think that relative thresholds are good design, and from what we've looked at in policies in other contexts. Applying, and this is difficult to explain without a graph, and we'll explain it more detail, applying 120 rand to 40% of emissions has a bigger marginal effect than if you apply 48 rand to 100% of the emissions, because it's the key difference being what an additional ton saves. And we think that, but you would only do this if you actually had an absolute threshold. It would leave a company that has the same emissions in 2016 as in 2015 in exactly the same position, but it would only provide that marginal effect for any growth of emissions. And as I said, the challenge is to slow the growth of our emissions or to reduce our emissions intensity, as some companies have set themselves goals. And so we think that particular design element should be considered. We do agree with what we've heard, that market mechanisms are important, but I think it's very important to distinguish. We're talking about economic instruments at a domestic level and international market-based mechanisms. These are potentially related. In fact, relating carbon tax to emissions trading schemes that are emerging is a complex issue. But I think for this discussion, the key question is what is happening domestically. Again, all of our analysis shows that carbon tax is an effective instrument. It's not the only instrument domestically, and particularly to modify behavior. In that regard, we agree with what the tax policy paper says. That's really the key thing that it sets out, that it would modify behavior as people see relative prices changing. That is a distinct discussion from the question of whether South Africa has access to international market-based mechanisms. Those are certainly important, and again some earlier work that you've done, particularly in the more energy intensive and trade exposed sectors, whether you do or don't have access to credits from such mechanisms makes a huge difference. In some cases it may turn negative impact into positives. And perhaps there should be some provision for credits, not only looking a little bit more ahead, not only to CERs and voluntary ECS credits, but also
interesting, I think it's Australia earlier this year, they have something they call the Jobs and Competitiveness Program, and so it might be worth considering. In relation to poor households, all I would add that I do think the specific instrument that might be used is interesting. So would this be an extension of free basic energy, which is broader than electricity, or to direct transfers to households? I mean, this is something that we've particularly seen being considered in Brazil, for example. And in principle, I'd be surprised if you couldn't quickly agree that the poor shouldn't suffer from a carbon tax. I would imagine that's a common cause. One very specific point is that we, in relation to what is done for energy intensive and trade exposed sectors, we think this is a very important area to address. But what the tax policy paper effectively does is only take the latter half, which is it only sets up criteria to see what the degree of trade is without considering the energy or emissions intensity of those exports, and we think it's important that both of those are included. We think in that kind of scheme it would be useful use of revenues and what CISL might call unbudget proposals, I think is perhaps the more acceptable terminology, for mitigation programs that can be done even in those sectors. And I think it's hard to think of a sector where absolutely nothing could be done. And so I think if there were programs that were within the overall budget that enable even those EITE, as we call them, energy intensive and trade exposed sectors, that it might be more difficult to reduce, this would be a sensible way of coming up with an overall policy package. I've deliberately not started with electricity, as Gina and Maggie and Steve will hopefully appreciate, but I can't keep you up. And I imagine, Steve, that the 160 rand per ton that you spoke about are primarily due to the broad program. Certainly, pretty much all the price paths in IRP 2010 were very, very similar, regardless unless they were built other than emissions 3, which is not one that we are concentrating that we are considering. And so, we do think that it's important to have a carbon price specifically, and that now is the time to introduce it at this low level. And I'll come back to two more points. I think, as the colleague next to me has said, what are the alternatives? So if electricity were to be exempt, what is the alternative instrument? Is it a regulatory instrument? Is it the IRP? If so, what certainty do we have that the IRP will be implemented as planned, or that when it is updated, it will be updated, will be less rather than more emissions intensive? And given the ministerial determinations that we've seen in relation to who builds electricity, this is no longer such a simple question. So we do think that the issue at hand here in the carbon tax discussion is the pass-through of electricity prices to consumers. But if not that, if there's a proposal that the electricity sector is exempt, then the question I do think is arises is, well, what happens and how does that happen? And then my final point here about the paper is that we see in the paper that the paper has a lot of language about a long-term price signal, but we don't think that it's clear that it actually does propose what can be really called a long-term price signal. We've both, in fact, often heard industry call for clarity on long-term price paths, and these are important where there are investments that last for decades. Firstly, it's not clear whether the first is over a 5-year period that the price increases. The climate change terms
not going to add too much to what Harold said. It's just a few very brief general comments. First of all, I think there's no doubt that that increasing energy prices have an impact on the way in which we use energy. As Harold said, the actual price at which the carbon tax is currently being proposed is unlikely to have a major impact, given the other impacts on the energy price at the moment, from particularly in electricity as a result of the new build and various other structural changes, and also in liquid fuels as a result of the increase in the crude oil price internationally. However, I think there is some rationale in introducing a carbon tax at this point. And I think the reason is that experience from a range of other countries around the world, including the European Union and other countries that have some kind of carbon pricing regime, is that this takes quite a long time. The institutional mechanisms that are necessary to do this, in the case of the ETS, took between 5 to 7 years of really detailed institutional design. And if we want to introduce a carbon price as a major part of our mitigation efforts, we need to start undergoing that process. And this is not just a case of making decisions about the level and exactly where the tax is going to be levied, but it's really largely about the provision of information, the independent auditing of that information, etc., etc. And these are very complex things which need to be put in place. And it's very clear at the moment that we do not have the information base at the moment to do this. So we would need to develop a far more precise information structure over the long term. And so, in a sense, even though the actual price itself will probably only become effective once it has increased considerably, there are significant benefits to introducing it in the short term. And one of the byproducts of energy taxes around the world, which the world underestimates, the availability of data systems. And this is a dire problem that we're facing at the moment. We just simply do not know enough about our emissions. Just some other points about the international regime. It's not entirely true that we're sticking our necks out on this at the moment. But one of the interesting things about the last 5 to 10 years is that there is very widespread activity in developing countries towards developing coherent national mitigation policies. Shifting large sums of money into investments in renewable energy. And one of the interesting things about the renewable energy industry is that its center of gravity has shifted in the last 5 years to the developing world. China is now the largest manufacturer of both wind turbines and PV panels. India is looking at investing enormous amounts in solar thermal over the next 20 years, etc. There are also efforts in a number of developing countries to introduce either trading systems or taxes of some kind. And given the timescales that we're looking at, it's very unlikely that we will be the only country in this position at that point. In terms of our national policy, it states very clearly that we should be making our what is considered to be a fair contribution to the international effort. And this is a very important part of our legitimacy in the international negotiations. If we aren't prepared to effectively take leadership in some way, or at least keep up, then our position in the negotiations is far less credible. And we do need an international binding regime in the long term, because as other speakers have pointed out, the impact are considerable and will become even more considerable from climate change. In terms of the actual design issues, I think Harold has covered most of that. Just in terms of the comments from ESCOM about the effective carbon price, our calculations are a bit different from that, and we'd be very interested to see how they got to those figures. I think also the IEP, as it was modelled at the time, it was a probably unprecedentedly extensive and open process in South Africa in the history of energy planning. The carbon constraint that was contemplated in the IRP was done so without a national context. And so it is very necessary to have a debate about exactly what share of mitigation the electricity sector should be assuming, and to do that within the context of an economic analysis. And the last point I think is that, as a lot of other speakers have said, the carbon tax is not a sort of a silver bullet. It's widely recognized internationally as being a very effective way of reducing emissions in the long term, and the primary way in which it does it is that it sends signals to both investors and consumers. So the economic rationale for introducing something like a carbon tax is to increase the allocated efficiency of an economy, and that's what we should be aiming to do in the long term. What is evident, though, from a lot of the work that we've done on this is that the way these measures are implemented and what other measures are implemented with them makes an enormous difference to the outcome. There's ample evidence to suggest that merely introducing something like a carbon tax could have very detrimental outcomes. It depends very much on exactly what drives those programs and how we deal with the implications. So whether we have new types of local industry or not, whether we have plans in place to mitigate the impacts on the poor, and so on and so forth. And the package, the whole package is actually critical to understand, to really understand the outcome. I think that's partly where we should be debating, is exactly what the package looks like and how we can best make the most use of this. I think the Chinese example is very interesting. The whole renewables industry in China was largely driven by industrial policy rather than mitigation policy initially, and that's the way they chose to do it. They're now developing, or they have developed, a very significant domestic market as well, but their approach to this has meant that those industries have had an enormously positive impact on the Chinese economy. And so the way in which all these measures fit together, I think, is critical. The final thing is just about regulation. I think that it is true that liquid fuels are regulated. I think that it's not a question that has been answered properly in the Treasury's paper on how exactly the tax will play through the value chain in the liquid fuel sector. But this isn't clear at all. So, for instance, there are some producers who have very high emissions in the sector, and there are some who have much lower emissions in terms of intensity, and it's not very clear how this will translate into any kind of price signal to consumers. So it's probably necessary to look at this in a much broader context in terms of the way we actually regulate that market. And if not that, then I think it is a reasonable question to ask as to whether a more regulatory approach would be easier to implement. I have to disagree with Sapir about the cost of regulation. I think that given that they're benchmarked against international refineries, I think those refineries are required to produce fuel on the international market, which frequently has the same types of fuel characteristics, and I think that's where we need to focus our attention, is on the actual regulatory system.
Thank you very much. I think I'll allow the few hands before we take a break. We need about a 10 seconds left to come across the break. You know, the trend is. It's nice because we are really engaging. And remember, scribbling for good. Do we understand each other? Are we clear? You know, we come from the different, you know, platforms and experiences. Maybe if this is a contribution towards some kind of a tunnel, that would be helpful, you know. But as I say, but I'm struck by what, you know, the DDG has said, you know, that the emphasis is more about the outcome rather than to say carbon dioxide, you know, on the table. But there must be a start somewhere. But also we need to keep in mind the fact that it seems that start now and start to don't start later. You know. I'm provoking this because some of the inputs were making reference to timing, you know. Why if this is not timing, maybe it comes back to what CDG has said, that okay, fine. A couple of things. How do we, what do we put on table to have the same outcome? So at the end of the day, we must ensure the reduction of emissions. But before I start getting clever, to capture everything, let me get the last three hands or four hands, then we take a break.
The models don't have the level of sophistication to pick up
you, Chair. I like your concept of two nadering, because I think that certainly there needs to be two nadering on what is high and what is low. It is not a low starting point. Eskom is correct. We also calculate that the starting price, once we adjust for the Z factor, would be 54 rand a tonne. There's already 35 rand a tonne charged on the electricity levy. That's 89 rand a tonne. And whether we agree that the shadow price is 116 rand a tonne, or it's 100 rand a tonne, or it's 90 rand a tonne, it would still be added to that. So that is a high price. It's not a low price in any one language. But let me come to the challenge of the alternative. We don't need to seek an alternative. The Department of Environmental Affairs is clear in its white paper that they are going to introduce a number of regulatory measures. They are going to ask every significant emitter in the economy to develop a mitigation plan, in which we will say, in negotiation with them, this is how much we're going to reduce year by year. If we reduce by that amount, we certainly shouldn't have to pay a tax from zero time, even with a rebate. If we don't, it's another question. The Department of Energy has also indicated to us, and it is in the National Energy Efficiency Strategy, that they will require of us an energy management plan, which will achieve the same effect, in that we will have to commit individually at firm level to specific energy efficiency improvements, which in themselves then result in greenhouse gas emission reductions. These are two instruments that are currently in development. The Department of Energy is far advanced. They expect to publish it for public comment in the next month. So these are instruments that have to be seen in the context of the carbon tax. And this is the difficulty that we have, that on the one hand we have this carbon tax paper which doesn't reference any of these other instruments and say how they will link with them. So that in effect we're going to be paying to implement the mitigation plan, the energy management plan, the mandatory reporting, which is also going to be imposed on us in both energy consumption and greenhouse gases, and we're going to pay the tax. That is why we believe that this two-nadering is so important, because clearly we're not reaching each other on what our experience is in reality and what Treasury thinks our experience is. So I really do want to appreciate the fact that you've got us here today, Chairman, and I hope it won't be the last time. Thank you.
On poverty is, given that there are, I think, about 2 million households that aren't receiving electricity, that a lot of people aren't receiving the free basic electricity, so they won't benefit from any increase in free basic electricity allocation. I don't have, and I don't know, maybe other people have detailed information on whether free basic alternative energy is really being rolled out anywhere in any significant way. So And then the other issue, which was a reduction on VAT, well, the poor are often reliant on non-VAT goods, so that wouldn't be passed through as a benefit. So maybe some clarity around the alternatives that Treasury has looked at in terms of how they might mitigate poverty. Thank you.
No, quickly, no, which has, I can't remember now. No, 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 next to you. Yes. I just said, just come down the line.
Yeah, I'd just like to add two things. One that Dr. Lennon mentioned was this issue of interdepartmental coherence. You know, it's Sean Nell from the EIUG. That Dr. Lennon raised around the issue of interdepartmental coherence. This discussion would obviously be a very different discussion if the economy was flying along at 6%. It clearly isn't. We can't on one hand be looking at ways in which we can reduce returns that organisations are having, and on the other hand, looking at ways in which we can prop up manufacturing and mining sectors which are in terminal decline. And the last question I have, which relates to what our colleague Liz said, is the fact that free basic electricity is already carried as a subsidy within the electricity price, will Treasury be looking at restructuring the tariffs to take up some of those subsidies and levies that already exist in there?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Congressman Mayor from Desire. We agree that there's a national development plan and it's a very good plan, although there are big constraints on that. But we also have a beneficiation strategy in the country that hopefully we will be able to make higher value products to be exported at a higher price. Currently, there's already people leaving the country, taking their business elsewhere before COVID. So we must just be aware that we might end up as an exporter of raw materials and end up as a hollowed out place of destitute people with no resources left. Just, I've also got just a question. Can we afford this low tax that everybody's talking about? Why is offset limited to 5%? And we are a country, we emit less than 1% of the global CO2 emissions. Should we be a leader? Can't we be rather a fast follower?
Thank you, and it's wonderful. Lead rather fast follower. Okay, Nunda.
Thank you, Chairman. Kevin Morgan from the Energy Intensive Users Group. Chair, you may have heard that I've dropped the EIT bulletin component since I heard the EPG referred to some companies getting electricity. They're cheap. I'm sure you wasn't referring to that. I'm very happy to defend that either on this or that occasion, Chair, or on some other occasion. But I think I'd like to align myself with the views expressed by my colleagues from industry. We all belong to the same industry associations, and I think we have a common position on it. But I think there's one issue, Chair, which hasn't yet come up for discussion, which I think would be quite useful to raise in the second part this afternoon, and that's the issue of revenue recycling. Treasury speak of revenue recycling, and we'll all pay the tax and we'll get it back in some way. And I think it would be an interesting conversation to understand how that would happen, because from our side there's probably a lack of clarity, Chair, about how exactly that is intended to work. Thank you.
So, Chair, let me take a different tack just to keep it interesting. And I'm happy Momo has commented to say that I shouldn't act as a turkey in our mouth. So, definitely I'm going to take a different tack here. Everybody that I've heard has said two or three very similar things. And I'm pleased to hear Momo said it. And, Chair, I have to commend you. This meeting now that I see it, I think quite a good understand the context. You started something much bigger, I think, Chair, than you appreciate. And it's this issue about getting people to talk them in the room, because I think they should be putting on the table. Let's have a look at the new IRP updated plan. I would suggest if we look at a 50-year view of the bull generation, we may say, heck, we don't need a carbon tax, because we're basically phasing out carbon just by basically following PPD. And if that's the case, then we understand that. Then we accept that the prices are not the impact on the economies. I'm not saying good or bad. I'm merely saying let's look at all the issues on the table. Let me just quote you a few. We've got a water strategy currently out, or shortly out for comment. That has a profound impact on this plan. Let me give you an example. There's an insistence that we have to do desulfurization on new coal-fired power stations. Let me give you a quote. A current power station, I think, uses something like 8 units of electricity without it, and I think it's something like 40 with it. But the problem is that water is then full of sulfur. So we solve the air problem, and we create a massive water problem. We're not talking to each other. Let's go on. We've got an integrated energy plan currently being put on the comment. We don't know what its content is, and I think when we see it, we will have a different view of this discussion on climate change and on carbon rights. We've got a national development plan which calls for certain things, and it's not consistent with some of the things that the other plans are calling for. We are asking, can we just have a discussion to get our minds around how these things will fit into each other? We then have a carbon tax. We have a carbon budgeting process. From a white paper. And in fact, there was a study done which warned very seriously of introducing simultaneously carbon budgeting and a carbon tax. We've not heard any comment on that. So I fully welcome what Noma is putting out here. Let's sit down and discuss all those things together, not in a threatening way, but that we can understand the inconsistencies between them. So yes, let's get here. Let's get National Treasury, Department of Energy, Trade and Industry, DMRDP together, and we'd like to be there too, because remember, we are the recipients of these issues, and we have views on it, which may not necessarily be aligned with what government wants to do, but government must decide it. They have the prerogative. We get that. So I'm suggesting to you, we've started a great process. Why don't we sit around the table and look at all these things together, and not look at them in silos without the benefit of looking at the impact interactively of these particular issues. Thank you, Chair.
Down, it's from 2.8 to 2%, only 8.9%. think too that it is important that other players are also here, as we said, talking about this and so on. And again, I think as Cecil has said, there is quite a lot of coordination, not necessarily perfect. And yes, there are performance issues often, and that's why you need to hold public servants like me accountable. You must find me if I don't perform. Okay? So at various levels, we need that. Okay? I think that what I would just appeal to, and of course we want higher growth, and so on, and of course at the moment we need lower growth, and you know, when the cake is not growing, you tend to fight more than the cake is growing, or how best to shape. But I think what I would want to appeal is that there is, though, I don't get a sense of the mindset change. You know, when you introduce a capital gains tax, people will come and doom and gloom. Okay? I don't think that's helpful. Okay? And I think that's why the tax discussions that Mr. Mufamadi has left are always hot. And we try and have a very consultative process. Doesn't mean we get agreement, but there's a way forward that you try and take into account the various impacts on the various players. And we understand. I mean, I understand if you're a mining company, a private company, we want those companies to be profitable. We don't want to destroy them. Nobody's so reckless. And if there is a mindset in the change in the discussion, I think we can try and obviously deal with this in a constructive, in a more constructive way. I think when it comes to, and I know I've picked on ESCOM, it's just that how people come, this is, that's the end, okay? No profit motive there. Sure, if it's ESCOM, the price is going to be get to the consumer, there's mitigation efforts. In a sense, price does is a powerful mechanism to try and deal with emissions. And as you said, nobody said here that's the only thing, that you need a whole set of complementary measures, special terms of measures. And I think that if you really want to, and compared to some of you aren't here, he knows that there are vibrant discussions when there are tax issues. But my worry is that if the mindset is not right, it becomes, doesn't have to be an organized lobby, but it becomes a very powerful lobby to say no. And I believe that if you put on any tax, you're going to get lobbies to say no. So how does government actually try and get these issues on the table? Because, and I think as people have pointed out, whether it's the funding of SARI, whether it's the future of the electricity levy, whether it's the fuel levy, which is also a form of carbon taxes, I mean, we've already got a range. And yes, everyone may be doing something, but the question is, are we doing enough to save the world? Are we doing enough to act globally and to act domestically? And the point is that if you look at the Stern report, the longer we are not doing more than we are doing,